Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
We also explain words and language rules, all while bringing you stories and information from around the world. Today on the program, you will hear stories from John Smith, Phil Dierking, and Anne Ball. Later, Kelly Jean Kelly will have this week's report on America's presidents. But first, some government officials in Taiwan are unhappy with pro-China political statements by Taiwanese universities. The government officials believe that such statements are hurting their efforts to reduce the island's dependence on China. Taiwanese media say as many as one-third of Taiwan's 152 centers of higher education have prepared statements supportive of China's political beliefs. Many of these colleges and universities are private and depend on money from overseas students. They expect that the number of Taiwanese students will fall, so they are trying to persuade Chinese from the mainland to study on the island. The statements usually promise that mainland students will not be given information suggesting Taiwan and China are separate countries. The statements also promise to block their exposure to information supporting Taiwan's legal independence from China. Liao Pei'an works at Taipei's Shixin University, a private school for students interested in working for news media. She said, "We are saying to mainland Chinese students that our curriculum won't touch on politically sensitive activities and that we won't carry out One China, One Taiwan, Two Chinas, or Taiwan independence activities." Taiwan's Ministry of Education would not tell VOA how many schools have prepared pro-China statements. But on its website recently, the ministry said exchanges of students should be equal, win-win, as well as respectful of academic freedom. China's communist leaders say Taiwan is part of the country, yet the island has operated under a separate government since the 1940s. Public opinion surveys show most Taiwanese want their island to remain independent of mainland China. But China says the two sides must someday become one. Some parents in China fear political differences might cause conflicts between their children and the Taiwanese. Nathan Liu is a professor at Mingxuan University in Taiwan. He says universities and government agencies in China that approve study programs in Taiwan may believe they must be more careful because of the island's current leadership. He says the pro-China statements might be designed to deal with these concerns. Liao says Shixin University prepared its pro-China statement because some local governments in the mainland needed it before approving study in Taiwan. The pro-China statements were released after Tsai Ing-wen was sworn in as Taiwan's president in May 2016. Observers say the statements weaken her efforts to lessen Taiwan's economic dependence on China. She wants to improve economic relations with India and countries in Southeast Asia. Tsai's government and officials in Beijing have yet to talk with each other because they cannot agree on whether Taiwan is part of China or a separate nation. This lack of agreement has angered China. So some experts believe China is using economic measures to try to weaken Tsai.
Many reporters have been killed in Syria. Others have been forced to leave the country, or frightened into doing so. But believable information can still be gathered about what is happening there. A worker at the Carter Center in Atlanta, Georgia, recently discovered how. Christopher McNabbo is the manager of the Syria Conflict Mapping Project at the center. He says he discovered that many people in Syria use the internet.
Syrians, and actually people in the Middle East in general, are 2 to 4 times as likely to share information about politics and religious views online.
Before he became the manager of the project, McNabbo was an intern at the Carter Center. He says he discovered that the conflict in Syria was different than others.
There are actually more minutes of video than of real-time conflict. The Syrian conflict represents a major paradigm shift in the way in which conflict plays out. Previous conflicts did not take place in connected environments like Syria.
McNabbo discovered he could use Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter to gather information on where fighters were in the country, who they were fighting for, and who was joining them. He was able to document the formation of more than 7,000 opposition armed groups in the country. Some of the groups are no longer active. In the case of Syria, there's just too much. Videos, Facebook posts, tweets, blogs, photos, you name it. Syrians are very active about getting information out, he said. One of the first things we started seeing online was the announcement of defections. As the conflict turned violent, people started defecting from the Syrian security forces, and they did so online. McNabbo now works full-time to map the war in Syria. He shares his information with mediators and humanitarian groups to help them understand the conflict. The information available online ranges anywhere from political statements and defections and armed group formations to footage of the actual fighting and humanitarian relief efforts. You name it, says McNabbo. Former President Jimmy Carter told VOA, the information can help aid groups.
So when the United Nations needs to find the best avenue to take in relief supplies, we can tell them which way to go.
The Carter Center publishes some of its maps and reports about Syria. They are used by reporters, nonprofit groups, and governments. Carter says he gave some information to President Vladimir Putin when Russian forces entered Syria in 2015.
When he got ready to join in and bomb factions within Syria, I wanted to make sure he bombed the right ones, or at least he knew what he was bombing. So I sent him a message through his embassy and said, we have this capability in Syria to tell you where things are, where people are located. Do you want to have that? And so the next day I got a response from him, yes, I would like to have your maps. So we sent our maps on a current basis to President Putin. So when he bombs in Syria, he knows from us where the different people in Syria are located.
McNabbo says the Carter Center wanted Russia to know that the center could watch their targets in Syria. Some observers are worried that some military forces will use the center's maps and reports. But McNabbo says the center does not share information that puts people at risk.
If you're a combatant in a conflict and you don't know where the front lines are, our information is not going to help you too much. You've got bigger problems. And so we're very careful of what we make totally public. We want our effort to pursue peace and support peace efforts and do everything it can to reduce the risk to civilians and any participant in the conflict.
I'm John Smith.
In sub-Saharan Africa, Lagos has long been known as Nigeria's center for pop culture. It is home to Nigeria's film industry, Nollywood. And many of the country's most well-known musicians and artists live there. But a group of rappers and fashion designers are creating their own cultural community in another city, Kaduna. The northern Nigerian city is about 600 kilometers from Lagos. DJ Jakes Tudu is a disc jockey, or DJ, in Kaduna. On his weekly radio show, he plays the latest music from local rap artists. Hip-hop is very popular in Nigeria, and rappers like Morel, DJ AB, Kings, and Classic are part of a new generation of Kaduna musicians. They are trying to put Kaduna and northern Nigeria on the music map. To most people, Kaduna may seem like a quiet and conservative city, but its growing music scene shows there is much more to the town. One popular music artist in Kaduna is Kevin Words. He is a local celebrity thanks to songs like Heaven. DJ Jakes is a very big fan of Kevin Words.
Stepping into Kaduna music industry, you have to listen to the likes of Kevin Words because a lot of people out there have this stereotype or this mindset that Kaduna artists Kaduna industry is full of mediocres. And when you hear people like Kevin Ward, man, trust me, you want to sit up.
Another of Kaduna's rising stars is 28-year-old Ibrahim Ilya. His stage name is IBI. Ibrahim mixes Hausa, the local language, with American hip-hop style. His recent hit song is called Alhamdulillah. Ibrahim says he fell in love with rap music at a young age. He makes rap music now because he still loves it. He says many of Kaduna's rappers move to Lagos to try to advance their music careers. But Ibrahim wants to stay in Kaduna and help build the city's music scene.
Yeah, I'm not actually against people going to Lagos, but if Kaduna people, they can just build themselves alone, reach a certain level, I mean, Lagos is nothing now. We'll counter them.
Music is just one part of hip-hop culture in Nigeria. Fashion is also important. And Kaduna has also become a promising place for young designers. One successful designer is Husena Raji. She is the CEO of Mummies Fashion. She designs clothes that combine both urban and African styles.
I decided to blend hip-hop because it's, I mean, that's a selling, that's what's selling right now in the market. Almost everybody wants to wear and feel like it. So we try as much as possible to make everything look it.
Mixing styles is popular now among Kaduna fashion designers. One of them is 24-year-old Patrick Yamai. He tries to mix professional styles with casual ones. He likes to make clothes that can be worn to work, as well as out to restaurants and bars in the evenings. His label, YKP Clothing, tries to keep an African influence in all of its styles as well. Yamai did not start out as a fashion designer. He studied accounting in school, and DJ Jake studied architecture. But they each grew to care about building Kaduna's own art scene. As DJ Jake said, he has a passion for Northern talent and is trying hard to promote it. I'm Phil Dierking.
Scientists who study primates say that we are moving towards a time when species like gorillas will no longer be found in the wild. They say orangutans would be gone too, and Madagascar would lose its lemurs. Joe Setchell is a primatologist at Durham University in Britain. She studies primates, the group of mammals that includes gorillas, chimps, monkeys, gibbons, mandrills, and lemurs. And, of course, humans.
So if we have 60% threatened with extinction at the moment, then we will see that number rise, and within our lifetimes, within our children's lifetimes, we will eradicate other primates.
In all, there are an estimated 600 different species of primates. They include the little creature called the mouse lemur, whose body is only about 6 centimeters long. Then there is the largest of the species, the gorilla, weighing up to 250 kilograms. Primates face one common threat, loss of habitat, the places in nature where they live. Primatologists like Setchell say human activity is to blame.
The major problem is habitat loss and habitat conversion. And essentially, it's humans changing primate habitat into human habitat, logging for timber, logging for conversion to agriculture, logging for cattle ranching, anything essentially that destroys tropical forest, because primates are largely tropical forest species.
More than half of all primate species are grouped in 4 countries: Brazil, Indonesia, Madagascar, and the Democratic Republic of Congo. Paul Garber says each of these countries is working to help protect the primates in their areas. But often there is neither the funds, community support, nor in-country expertise to address their conservation problems. Madagascar is a good example of these problems, he says. It is home to over 100 primate species. Almost all of them live nowhere else. And 94% of them are endangered. 90% of the original forests of Madagascar have been cut down, Garber says. Neither Garber nor Setchell have any easy answers about how to stop this road to extinction.
We knew that primates were in trouble, but I think even for those of us who work in primate conservation, it was still shocking to discover quite what the scale of the problem is.
They do say that the clearest way is to slow human activity in primates' habitats. They also say the decrease is reversible if humans make primate and habitat conservation a top concern. I'm Anne Ball.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. James Monroe easily won election in 1816. He had a relaxed, likable personality and was popular with voters. In addition, many saw him as a last connection to the country's founding generation. Monroe had fought in George Washington's army during the Revolutionary War against British rule. He was a diplomat during Thomas Jefferson's presidency and helped complete the Louisiana Purchase. Monroe served as James Madison's Secretary of State and briefly as his Secretary of War as well during the War of 1812. Voters' positive feelings carried Monroe into office and defined his presidency. When Monroe became president, the United States had just declared victory against British forces in the War of 1812. The American economy was also doing well, at least at first, and the government was mostly united under a single party. But Monroe did have one immediate problem. He and his wife, Elizabeth, could not move into the president's house right away. The British had burned it badly in an attack on Washington, D.C. Workers were busy making repairs. So Monroe decided to go on a trip. He spent the first weeks of his presidency traveling. He went north into New England, visiting important places from the Revolutionary War or the War of 1812. Everywhere he went, he reminded Americans of their shared, proud history. He even wore clothes in the old colonial style. One of Monroe's nicknames is the Last of the Cocked Hats. Then President Monroe turned west, toward lands that white migrants were increasingly settling. They were able to move west in part because American soldiers had defeated a powerful alliance of Native American tribes. What had been a victory for the U.S. government was a crushing loss for Native Americans. Many tribes moved farther west. Others began to lose their languages and their customs as white settlers took control. For Monroe, however, the visit west was a positive sign of the country's expansion. By the time he returned to Washington, Monroe had met many Americans. He had learned for himself the geography of the country, and he had demonstrated that all parts of the U.S. could be connected by patriotism and a common federal government. One newspaper called Monroe's presidency the beginning of an era of good feelings. 4 years later, Monroe won a second term even more easily than his first. Yet James Monroe's presidency had several crises. One was the country's first economic depression in more than 30 years. Another was over slavery. The country had been divided over the issue since its founding. By the end of 1819, 11 states, all in the South, permitted slavery. 11 states, all in the North, did not. The question became, would the new states in the West permit it? Monroe had to face the question when settlers asked Congress permission for Missouri Territory to become a state. Many enslaved people already lived there. White settlers expected to bring more. But a member of Congress from a northern state proposed that Missouri could become a state only if it banned slavery. That proposal started a debate that lasted more than a year. For the most part, the debate was not based on the moral problems with people owning other people. Instead, it involved economic and political concerns. Northerners argued that slaveholding states had an unfair economic advantage. In addition, If Missouri entered the Union as a slave state, its lawmakers would move the balance of power toward the South. The debate continued so long that another area asked to enter the Union. People in northern Massachusetts wanted to organize into an independent state called Maine. After some time, lawmakers offered a compromise. They said Maine could be admitted as a free state and Missouri as a slave state. But they also made a line across a map of the country. They said Congress would not admit another slave state north of that line. James Monroe signed into law what became known as the Missouri Compromise. It settled the issue of slavery, at least officially, in the U.S. for more than 20 years. But everyone knew that the peace between pro-slavery and anti-slavery groups was only temporary. In 1823, Monroe made one of the most important foreign policy decisions in American history. It became known as the Monroe Doctrine. It related to Spain's colonies in Latin America. Monroe had dealt with Spain before. In his first term, he and his Secretary of State, John Quincy Adams, successfully negotiated with Spain to buy Florida for the United States. By Monroe's second term, Spain had also lost control of some of its former colonies in Latin America. The president became concerned that Spain's European allies would try to help the country regain power. He did not want European powers interfering in areas so close to U.S. territory and so important to U.S. trade. So Monroe gave a speech to Congress. He said, the U.S. would stay out of Europe's affairs. But, he said, Europe should also stay out of Latin America's affairs. And Monroe declared that European powers would not be permitted to begin colonizing any area in the Western Hemisphere. In other words, Monroe declared that the U.S. considered the entire Western Hemisphere its sphere of influence. Historians note that Monroe did not aim for the Declaration to be a major statement, but it became a base of American foreign policy and supported U.S. expansion throughout the 19th century. James Monroe was the fourth and last president in the Virginia dynasty. Except for John Adams, four of the first five American presidents were from Virginia. Monroe and his wife returned to their home there after he left office. They had a close relationship with each other, as well as with their two surviving children, both daughters. Unlike many politicians of his time, Monroe had brought his family with him on his travels. He also believed strongly in education for girls. When the Monroes lived in France, young Eliza Monroe attended the best school for girls in Paris. This loving family spent as much time together as possible. So, when Elizabeth Monroe died, James Monroe was filled with sorrow. His health also began to fail. He moved to the house of his younger daughter, Maria, in New York City. James Monroe died there 1 year later at age 73. Like two other former presidents, Monroe died on the 4th of July, America's birthday. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.